I'm Adam Rappaport. Welcome to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. Today we have a sort of a two-for-one deal. We have the chef of one of London's most popular and celebrated restaurants, and I'm going to say the most influential cookbook author in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, Ramel Scully. Did I say it right, Ramel?
That's right. You did say it right.
Close enough.
Close enough.
And Yotam Ottolenghi, fresh from London. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, Adam.
So you guys got a new cookbook out, Nopi, which is the restaurant you guys opened in 2011.
That's right.
All right. What I love about this cookbook, and I haven't cooked from it yet, but Yotam, you write a very sort of charming introduction. And what I love about this introduction is it says a lot. It's kind of like you talk about the collaboration and the sort of creative tension that you and Scully had. We just call him Scully, right?
Yeah, he's Scully for everybody apart from his mom when she's angry at him.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, he's Scully.
So talk about that, because as a creative guy, I find it fascinating that you do things a certain way with the Ottolenghi cookbooks and in your shops, and then here comes this chef you hired who did things his way.
Yeah. Well, every collaborator, I guess, has this problem. And I try to describe it as honestly as I can in the introduction to the book. Essentially, Scully started working with me about 10 years ago and has come with a very clear sense of identity, which was very clearly different from the way I cooked and Sami Tamimi, who is my business partner and creative partner, works.
And so, you hired him at one of your shops.
We hired him to run the dinner service at one of our restaurants. And Scully comes from a Malaysian and Australian background. So a lot of Asian influences, a lot of Asian food. But we are doing Middle Eastern food with a bit of Southern European, North African hints. And then all of a sudden, someone that wants to do, use miso, or he wants to use tamarind and all sorts of ingredients that obviously we know, but weren't part of our repertoire. But because he's so talented and because he does it so well and because he's very creative and he really does cook with the same bold flavors that we did. And at some point in 2011, we realized he was good enough to really run a kitchen and put his own food on the menu.
Okay, but you're saying that now. So let's rewind 10 years. Was it frustrating for you where you've got this very well-known, successful chef who, grew up in Israel and now in London, has all these partners, and he's trying to tell you how to cook and you want to do your thing?
Well, it was never telling me how to cook. It was just, I think, at the same time, was just telling me, Scully, you just have too many ingredients in one plate. How are we going to compromise this? And this taught me how to take criticism in that way. And it's actually taught me now more balance in my ingredients that I use. So 90% of the time, we always compromise about what we
You have to remember that when I met him, he was young and I was younger. So so it was actually, we went on a journey together.
How long, Scully, did it take you to sort of realize that you were learning and you were becoming a better chef by teaming up with Yotam and Sami and the guys?
I would think it was the second year. And the second year, we started working more on towards, we had 9 dishes on the menu, and he would basically give me 2 Asian dishes. Then I started learning how to use the Middle Eastern ingredients and mixing up with the Asian ingredients. And that was a breakthrough. On the third year, we started playing more and more and more.
Yeah.
And then when we opened Nopi, it was a big chance for me to really push the Asian with the Middle Eastern flavors.
At some point, we realized we can actually put some miso in our tahini, and it worked.
But is the common thread bold, vibrant flavors, whether it is Asian or Middle Eastern? What connects you guys?
Yeah, I mean, there's bold flavors. I mean, when you look at the map and you take off from the Middle East, from Israel or Lebanon or Palestine, all this corner of the Middle East, and you start going eastwards, you realize that there is this kind of a natural progression. So, you get more and more chilies as you head east. You get more and more certain herbs. You use more of them, more coriander, a little bit more mint, more of those flavors. But essentially, we're talking about the same palate, a lot of citrus, quite a lot of oils used, a lot of lentils and other grains used in the cooking. So essentially, it's not this huge breakaway from what we were doing. It's just an extension of what we were doing.
There was a fascinating piece in The New Yorker a couple of years ago, Yotam, on you and your team, and Jane Kramer wrote. And I thought what was so interesting about that article was that Americans know Ottolenghi from your cookbooks. You're hugely successful here and hugely, I think, influential in terms of how we eat, as a sort of modern food culture in a magazine like this one, just with the bright flavors, the herbs, the grains, vegetable forward. And the piece revealed that Ottolenghi is more of a a brand, a machine than it is a person. Yeah. You guys really are a team there.
We really are a team. And this is what I always try to, I mean, not every journalist wants to see that because often they want to pinpoint one person and say, that's the person. But actually, whenever I get an opportunity, I always try to say how important it is as a collaborative. It's a bit like, you know, it is a, in essentially, it's a, an incubator for different creative people to come together and do things in collaboration on or on their own. So Sammy and I are the first example. And then afterwards, Kim Scully, I'm working on a baking book at the moment with another person, with Helen Goh, who does a lot of our cakes.
Another Malaysian.
And in a sense, that's how we do things. And that's always been how we've managed to expand without losing our ability to innovate. And that's and it is really, Jane Cramer was spot on, shedding light on all of us, not just myself.
Was it tough for you, Scully, to feel like you're the fifth Beatle or trying to join this group? You know, like how when did you finally feel like you sort of belonged?
Well, to be honest, when we opened Opie, the first 2 years, I think it wasn't the feeling of not being belong. The food was already part of mine and part of the company, and then we putting together. I think we're just getting it right, and that was the hardest thing. That first 2 years opening Opie, we were all not sure what we really wanted in Opie. Yeah. And then the third year, I started feeling it. And then, you know, doing 200 covers a night, you start thinking as a chef, like three components on the dish really works well. It's efficient and it's always strong, bold flavors. That's why we always maintain that part.
And we always have a sense of, I mean, I always make a real, and Sammy as well, we always bring all the chefs together around the table with their ideas. We have a chef's meeting twice a month where young kids, you know, people that have only been in the company even less than a year, get to share their knowledge with the rest of us. They come in, they bring a salad, they bring a dish, and we try it, and we go like, okay, that's a really good idea. Maybe it can go on the menu where we can change it a bit and work with it. And it's always been my policy that that's the best way to grow.
There's the old saying, there are too many cooks in the kitchen. And you write about in the introduction, when you opened Opie, you had a three-person kitchen. Yeah. There was you, there was Scully.
There was a third person.
So, and that in itself, like, you have three head chefs in a kitchen. Like, how does that work? Or how does it not work?
Yeah, well, it doesn't always work. And when then it doesn't always work, then we change the model slightly. I mean, in a way, it started off by Sammy and myself working quite separately. I was more in charge of the pastries and the cake, and Sammy was doing the salads. Then when we realized that we can start giving advice to each other in each other's department, then all of a sudden we said, actually, this actually can work. We can encroach a little bit on each other's territory. And then, you know, and then it was just free for all. Everybody was kind of giving advice.
You do a column for Bon Appetit, Notes from My Test Kitchen. So I visited you, and I'm blanking on the neighborhood because I'm not from London.
But
Hampden. Okay, so you're Mr. Big shot, best-selling author, TV guy, columnist, and I go to your test kitchen. Like, wow, you are literally like underneath the railroad tracks in some sort of bombed-out warehouse district.
I'm definitely not in World Trade Center.
Yeah. So why not open someplace fancy and shiny and beautiful?
What is a test kitchen? Well, it's first of all, real estate in London is, well, I'm sure the same as in New York, yeah, but it's very expensive. We wanted something that is extremely practical, because the whole ethos of testing recipes, and I've always emphasized it, is about creating something, is that an environment that is as similar as possible to a home kitchen.
Yeah.
We don't have fancy gadgets. You saw that.
Yes.
We go and buy the ingredients in the supermarket rather than from our purveyors that are kind of, you know, the Italian, Japanese, and the Chinese. But not everybody has those suppliers, you know, supplying them into their kitchen. So from the day one, when I designed the test kitchen, I said I wanted to look like not even my kitchen, but someone that even doesn't have the best kitchen in the world. We can't even use gas there because it's not safe, because it's literally under a train. You know, the trains are going up and down constantly.
Rumble.
So we have to use electric, which isn't ideal. I mean, any chef would rather use gas, but we can't. So essentially, it's all about making it work for us. But I think these constrictions are very good for coming up with great recipes that work in normal kitchens.
Scully, so let me say, if you're an American and we're visiting London, what's the best way, do you think, to sort of experience the world of Team Ottolenghi's cooking, food? Where should we go? What should we order?
I think you got to start from the number one, the first Ottolenghi, which is in
Notting Hill.
Notting Hill. And then
explain that. It's like a shop slash cafe
deli.
What am I ordering when I go?
What you're ordering? Ooh,
yeah.
See, I'm a fan of his apple olive oil cake with the maple cream. It's one of my favorites still. And then I'll go for the polenta cake.
Do you eat just sweets, or is there anything savory to order?
The savory, or look, to be honest, it's you've got so many options between like 10 to 15 salads a day. Yeah. So I don't know where to start, to be honest.
How would you as a chef describe Yo Tam's cooking to someone who's never tried it?
Look, when 2005 I was looking for work on my second year in London, I applied for the job, and I remember I did some research before I went to the shop, and I walked past on the first day, and I was like, wow, this is amazing kind of layout, you know, and the big meringues. And I always tell Yo Tam he's built his business on egg whites and sugar, you know, those huge meringues.
Cheap.
Yeah, and as a young chef, I was thinking, I'm really hoping these guys make all these things fresh downstairs.
Yeah.
And when I walked in on that day for the trial, I was like, amazing. And that's just, as a young chef, that's respect already, that you know that everything that goes on the counter, it's made fresh on the spot every day, every night, and every morning. So definitely start from Notting Hill and then finish off in Upper Street because you have the dinner service, the sharing plates. That's where I always started from. And these days, go Nopi. There's you know, something different.
So, Scully, if you had to name five quintessential Otolenghi ingredients for someone who's not familiar with this food, what are some of the ingredients?
Number one, preserved lemon. It's always around. We non-stop making it fresh every day because we go through a lot every few months. So I'm always stocking up. The tahini, you know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that much tahini in my life and different tahinis. But he's taught me a few things. So you're talking about the black tahini and what is it? The red tahini?
And wholemeal tahini. And red,
And number three, I would say with the pulses like buckwheat and quinoa and you know, lentils.
Yeah.
It's all around. Number four would be the molasses.
The pomegranate molasses
and date molasses. And this is something 5 years ago I started using in my cooking too, different kind of sourness and sweetness. And I'll say number five.
I think you missed one, Scully.
Yeah?
Yogurt,
yes.
Oh, my God. Yogurt versus labneh. Okay. Is there a difference? What do you define as yogurt?
Yogurt is what it is, but labneh is yogurt that's been drained of most of its liquids, so it's firm.
Yeah,
and you can roll it into balls, and you can preserve it in olive oil. So essentially, it turns into very, very young cheese.
Oh.
But it's essentially yogurt that's just has a lower moisture content.
So if I have a jar of preserved lemons that I bought at the store, what give me three good ways to use them?
Okay, so you just take them and put them in your food processor, and you blitz them with a bit of olive oil and pinch of salt, if a spice, if you want, and there's your dressing.
Just throw it on a salad dressing. Or roasted vegetables or something.
Absolutely. Or you can chop it up, mix it with olives, capers, and you've got a salsa that could go over oily fish, can go over lamb, or everything something meaty. You can add it to your, you can blitz it up together with butter and and lemon juice, and put it over your roast chicken.
Ooh, wow.
You put it under the skin, and that preserved lemon. But the beautiful thing about preserved lemon, it does everything. It does the acidity. It does the perfume of the skin. It's like everything in one little neat package.
Yeah.
And it's just magical. It's a really wonderful drink.
It's kind of like almost like anchovies. It sort of just adds an element.
It also got that bitterness at the back of your palate. It's a nice bitter, you know what I mean? Yeah. So when you eat it.
And the longer you keep them, the better they get. Like after a year or 8 months, they're even better. When you go in Marrakesh, in the market, you see these jars and they start off by the lemons being yellow and then they go all the way to being brown. But the brown ones that have been there for a year or so have the most amazing flavor. Exactly. You just need patience. But normally you use them before you wait a year.
So when you're in town, like New York or something, what influences you? What are you guys going to check out while you're here?
We went to Momofuku Milk Bar for breakfast. Yeah. We had some cookies.
Just a little bit of sugar.
Yeah,
From there, we went to Bouchon Bakery for some more sugar. And we hardly arrived here. We were just like someone had to carry us because it was just too much. We haven't eaten anything savory today yet.
We haven't, not yet.
Just sweets.
But like, you come here a lot. So what do you like about New York? Or what interests you? What do you take back with you?
Well, I go to the traditional Jewish delis because I just love going there. We don't have that in London, and it's a wonderful thing to do. I really much prefer to go to the places that are kind of under the radar a little bit. I know I'm sure they're not under your radar, but not the top restaurant. Although I love Nomad, I love the food there.
I'm it's a fan perfect. Of Nomad too. Last time I was here, I went to Momofuku Co.
That's their tasting counter where it's a multi-course meal.
That blew my taste buds away, and then. A day later, we went to Levin Madison Park, different style of cooking, different style of cuisine. That blew my taste buds too in a certain way. So this time, I don't know what
you mentioned David Chang in the book.
Big fan of Lucky Peach.
As a chef, how do you perceive Chang, and what's his influence in the world of cooking?
I think being in the Asian background, how he just took Asian ingredients to the States and just done it in a different level. It's inspired me to take my Asian ingredients and make it one more step level.
But that's fascinating that you can, in this day and age, you can have an Asian American chef in New York helping influence a Malaysian Australian chef who now lives in London and works with an Israeli guy who, you know.
It's so beautiful. I mean, Scully is the sort of person that constantly reads magazines and books, and he comes to me and says, oh, we've got to try this.
Yeah.
And we're very open about these influences. And I think that's, again, it goes back to the collaborative spirit. The way everybody collaborates now, which is so much nicer than it used to be a while ago when chefs were all, it was all about the secrets. At the moment, it's all about sharing.
Yes. If you read the book, the burnt miso with butterscotch with the quail and then...
I have that. I actually have that flagged right here, I want to say.
I remember that day when I learned that from Lucky Peach, and I swear, I got to the kitchen, I made it, and I was jumping, and my chefs and servers were like, what the heck chef's doing? You know, I'm like, this is amazing.
So speaking of recipes, one thing you address in Nopi, the cookbook, and Yotam, in your introduction, you say, I like this line. This is your very first sentence. If you happen to have my previous cookbooks, Ottolenghi, Plenty, Jerusalem, and Plenty More, you will notice right away that the dishes in this book are somewhat more complex. Talk about that.
I wanted to get this out of the way as soon as possible because I thought, you know, we're doing something very different this time. It's the recipes that I've published in the past were created in the test kitchen or in my home kitchen. And this was always what I had in mind. Taking a flavor, a dish, an ingredient, and translating it to a home cook and creating it for a home cook. Here, the process was completely different. We took a dish that has already proved itself on a restaurant menu, started off very differently. And I write in the introduction, to create a dish for a restaurant, you know you're working in a very different environment. You've got a team of chefs cooking, doing mise en place for 3 hours for a very quick service that would last a couple of hours. And then they go home and clear it up, and there's got kitchen porters coming to clean, and everything works very differently for home.
You're also making food for people who expect to be impressed by what is put down in front of them.
But I think we often cook to impress, even at home and dinner parties. But it's not about that. It's about the ease of creating something that is very complicated and it's got a lot of components and is very involved. Now, I wanted to take these flavors and really make them work for home cooks. So I took the recipes, or we took the recipes. I got Scully to come to the test kitchen and try to, for once in his life, really try to make all these really complicated things doable in the home kitchen. But we only went halfway through. So we met our readers halfway through. You know, we said, okay, these are restaurant recipes. We'll simplify them for you. We might lose a thing or two. We might use an ingredient that you're not familiar with, but we'll tell you substitutes as well. But you might need to work harder, at least with some of the dishes, not with all of them.
Yes. Like the miso quail.
The miso quail is actually a simple dish to make.
Of course, you're going to say that.
I'll show you much more complicated dishes. You take your miso and you spread it out on a tray and you burn it in the oven. For 5 minutes, 7 minutes?
About 8 minutes.
Eight minutes? Yeah. You put it in a food processor with mirin. With
light brown sugar.
Sherry
vinegar.
Thank you, Scully. Yeah. You blitz it and you put it on your quail, you sear it, and the salsa is pomegranate seeds, chopped walnuts, and some seasoning. Really, that's all it is. It's a simple dish. Okay, it's not like, you might not cook it in 20 minutes, but you can cook it in an hour and a half.
Yeah. There
that's
you go.
Simple.
That's reasonable.
Yeah.
Scully, so Yotam is a veteran cookbook writer at this point. This is your first book.
Exactly. Yeah.
What did you enjoy about it, and what did you find really challenging about the process of putting all these recipes onto paper?
When Yotam approached me to do a cookbook from home cooks, I thought it would be a walk in the park. I really thought it would be so easy to do it. It was the hardest thing I ever did in 21 years cooking. Number one, I had to learn how to measure salt.
Yeah, because none of this stuff, you just grab a pinch here and throw
exactly.
it in. Exactly. And you do it like 5 times in the course of a recipe.
The first few months, like, Yotam, are you measuring the salt? I'm like, yeah. You know, like, so I learned that the hard way. And then number two was the ingredients. In a restaurant, we can call our supply and we get the best stuff. So the first 6 months, I was bringing a crate of ingredients from my Nopi kitchen. And then I've noticed that if I want to get it right for the home cooks, I had to learn how to be a home cook, go out shopping in supermarkets. Yeah. And that was a big thing for me. And I learned a lot what was in town in the UK. And I didn't know you can get Japanese yuzu juice. And then it started making me more creative in the way that you know, I really enjoyed making that book. And then I had to start thinking, if I was at home, I was prepping all day, and then my guest was coming at 4 o'clock. I got to make sure I look good, and the kitchen's nice and clean.
You always look good, Scully. Yeah,
thank you. And then the thing is but it's just like making it easy, reheating food. And then at the same time, I always find it hard to cook for one person, or one person for two people in your home. So I had to think that, you know, someone just like give example, the Asian master stock. I want to teach home cooks that you can actually make the stock and basically, and then recycle it for weeks and months or years. My mom has an Asian master stock in the freezer for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So I want to teach readers of that too. Like what we did in the restaurant, we can take it to the next level at your home. So.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations on the book, guys. The Nopi Cookbook out now. Pick it up. Yotam Ottolenghi and Ramel Scully. But before we go, we are going to subject you to our lightning round. Either or questions you have to answer. Some might be directed at one of you more than the other, but we'll give it a shot. Number one, pomegranate molasses or miso?
Ooh. Ooh. Why did you say that? Either or.
Pick one.
It's a big wrestling match right now.
Oh, gosh. So you would go for the
miso. Of course I'm going to go for miso. I've got to back that up.
Okay, I'll take the pomegranate molasses.
But you secretly love miso now,
I do
right?
love miso. Actually, miso
You're having an affair with it, miso, kind of.
I feel very bad. Miso is slightly more versatile.
I'm glad you admitted that. Duka or Togarashi?
Oh, Duka any day. Togarashi, if you take the other question, I mean, Togarashi is slightly more limited. Duka is good for cooking, good for sprinkling.
Chelsea or Arsenal?
Arsenal.
Oh, wow. That was all right. You guys agreed on something.
I live in North London, so
yeah, exactly. We both of us did.
Oh, I like this one. Falafel or shawarma?
Falafel.
I'm a shawarma fan.
You're a big guy. Our producer, Belle Cushing, supplied this question because she's smart. Yotam, Hegel or Kant?
Oh, God, that's not fair. I guess it has to be Kant, but yeah.
Why does it have to be?
Well, because I can understand what he writes, and Hegel I still haven't figured out, even though I've finished my master's in philosophy. It's too complicated for me.
Mint tea or English breakfast tea?
Oh, mint tea.
Mint tea.
English fresh mint or dried mint?
Fresh mint. Yeah. I mean, for English breakfast, you might as well have coffee.
Yeah.
All right, final question. I think I know the answer to this one, but we'll find out. Butter or olive oil?
Olive oil.
He's changed me, olive oil.
He's changed you. That's good to know.
I still love butter. I'm not going to lie to you.
No, we all like butter. Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Yotam Ottolenghi and Ramel Scully. Check out their new book, Nopi.
Thank you, Adam.
This podcast is brought to you by executive producer Belle Cushing and project manager Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. The theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.